Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for coming to this seminar about the South China Sea, West Philippine Sea ruling just recently made by the Philippine Court of Arbitration in The Hague. We have two fantastic, excellent speakers for this afternoon to present, to discuss the implications of this ruling, not only for the parties, the Philippines and China, but also to the broader region and the international community. Our first speaker is Professor Yu White, who is a recipient of the Order of Australia. He's professor of strategic studies at the Australian National University. His work focuses primarily on Australian strategic and defense policy, Asia-Pacific security issues, and global strategic affairs, especially as they influence Australia and the Asia-Pacific. He has served as an intelligence analyst with the Office of National Assessments, as a journalist with the Sydney Morning Herald, as a senior advisor on the staff of former Defense Minister Kim Beazley and Prime Minister Bob Hawke, and as a senior official in the Department of Defense, where from 1995 to 2000, he was Deputy Secretary for Strategy and Intelligence, and as the first director of the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. In the 1950s, he studied his philosophy at Melbourne and Oxford universities. Our second speaker is Dr. Lowell Bautista. He is lecturer at the School of Law and a staff member at the Australian National Centre for Ocean Resources and Security, the Faculty of Law, Humanities and the Arts, University of Wollongong. Dr. Bautista is recognized for his expertise on the law of the sea, especially in the area of territorial and maritime boundary issues in the South China Sea. He is a lawyer with over 10 years of experience in legal and policy research, litigation, and consultancy. Dr. Bautista, his areas of research include territorial and maritime boundary issues in the Asia-Pacific, the South China Sea, Philippine maritime and territorial issues, maritime piracy and terrorism, international humanitarian law, and a whole lot other range of topics. But without much further ado, I give the floor to our speakers, first to Professor Yu White. And I know that, so we will give our speakers 20 to 25 minutes each to discuss their presentation, and then after which we will open the floor for your questions.
Okay, well, thanks very much. It's a great pleasure to be here. Thanks to Ali for getting this together, and it's a great pleasure to appear with Lowell. I've got a great respect for the work of Wollongong on these issues. Many of my old friends and colleagues have worked there over the years. In a sense, we may be doing things a bit the wrong way around. Lowell knows a hell of a lot more about the law of the sea than I do. So I'll be giving a kind of a bigger picture frame for what I think is going on. And then I'm sure he'll give us much more detail about the specifics. So, you know, we all know the backstory. That's why you're here. Thank you all for coming. There has been this really quite remarkable, and I think remarkably stark, judgment delivered by the tribunal a couple of weeks ago now. And the big question is, well, what's this about and where's it going? I think the best way to understand where's it going is to recognise that it's about two different kinds of things. The first is it's about a series of contested maritime claims themselves. And that's an issue in itself of great significance. It's significant because of the potential resources involved in those claims to whoever's successful eventually in establishing authority over those maritime areas. And it's important as a question of national pride. I mean, national pride's a shorthand for something actually much bigger and more complicated. But for all of these countries, for all of their governments, for any country and government, in fact, questions of sovereignty, questions of territory, always go beyond the mere, you know, the sort of actual economic advantages or whatever. It's a, you know, it sort of gets you up down here as well as up here, or maybe in your heart. And I think we have to recognise that if all that was at stake were the fish and the minerals that might conceivably lie within the EEZs, to the extent that they attract the EEZs of the bits of territory we're talking about, then none of this would be as of much interest as it is. But there's obviously something more going on there. So that's all a pretty big deal. But as well, separately from the issues, specifically territorial or economic or even patriotic, that relate to the maritime claims themselves. I'm going to argue to you that there's something else separate and much bigger again involved in these in the dispute we see in the South China Sea and affected very strongly by the tribunal's award of the other week. And that goes right to the heart of the nature of the regional order in Asia. Because we all have got used to seeing Asia as working within a rules-based order, and we see the application of those rules to these disputes as a very significant test as to whether there really is a rules-based order in Asia, whether Asia is governed by rules or whether it's governed by power. And it's a test then, not just of particular countries' claims, but the judgment and the starkness of the judgment and how countries respond to the judgment becomes a test of the kind of region we're living in. And even beyond that, it's a test of what underlies that regional order, what underlies the, so to speak, the constitution of Asia or of East Asia. And that means it's a test of US leadership, because US leadership, US strategic primacy in Asia has been so important as the foundation for that rules-based order. It's a test of the US alliances, which support US leadership. It's support of the regional institutions, and I think in particular ASEAN as a regional institution. And of course, alongside all of those things, it's a test of China's place in the region and a test of China's ambitions and resolve to play a bigger role in the region. Now, let me just unpack each of those in turn. I think the starting point is to recognise that the idea of the rules-based regional order, the idea that Asia has built up over the last few decades, a way of doing business internationally, which is primarily rule-governed, which is, for example, very strongly supported by the Australian government that talks about the rules-based order, well, 56 times, I think, in the last white paper. That is, I think, we have to understand, very strongly based on the role that the United States has played in Asia over the last four decades, I would say, four and a half decades, really since 1972. Because what's at stake when we talk about that rules-based order, obviously, is, well, who makes the rules and who enforces them. And it's very much been the case over the last 40 years, I would say since Nixon went to China in 1972, that the rules in Asia have been made and upheld primarily by the United States, not solely by the United States, but primarily by the United States. The reason why I picked 1972 as the date at which that era started is from that point on, China ceased to contest America's role as the leading power in Asia, so US primacy in Asia became uncontested, which made it unusually easy for the United States to make and enforce those rules. And in saying that, I don't say anything negative about it. In fact, I think the era in which the United States has exercised uncontested primacy, the era in which it has been able to make and enforce the rules, has been an unusually beneficial one. And that's true notwithstanding the peculiar but significant fact that the United States, it's not itself, of course, ratified the Law of the Sea Convention. And the significance of that concept of who makes and enforces the rules for what's happening in Asia at the moment was very clearly, plainly, directly, even starkly expressed by President Obama himself several times, actually, in the last 2 years, but including most recently in a State of the Union address in January this year, when in seeking to urge the Congress to pass the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement, he said, and if this is not a direct quote, it's a pretty close paraphrase, if we, Americans, make the rules in Asia, China will make the rules, and we should make those rules. So the image of American leadership as being the factor which sets the rules in Asia is very clearly embedded in the way America sees things. And of course, implicit in the statement I just paraphrased, what we're seeing right at the moment is the Chinese challenging that fundamental place of the United States. When Xi Jinping talks about seeking a new model of great power relations, which is a phrase he uses with monotonous regularity. He means something very clear, I think, and very fundamental. That is, he wants to contest the leading role of the United States in setting the rules in Asia. He wants to overturn the regional order that's been built up since 1972. He wants to build a new order in which China plays a much bigger leadership role, a much bigger role in setting the rules, in which it has the power to defy the rules if it wishes to. And that is a very natural thing for China to want to do. That's what rising powers normally do. Worth bearing in mind, when China accepted US primacy back in 1972, it had an economy 1/20th the size of America's. It now has an economy which is in effect the same size as America's. So it's natural that China should want to play a bigger and more influential role, but it's also very scary. And the reason why there is so much attention being paid to the decision the other day, and the reason why the South China Sea issue has become such a really central issue in Asia, is precisely that it's a test of what we now see as a quite stark incompatibility in the basic strategic objectives of the United States and China in Asia. That is, the United States wants to remain the leading power in Asia and China wants to challenge. That's really reflected in who gets to set the rules and the status of the rules on maritime jurisdiction that we're seeing tested in the South China Sea has turned out to be, as history would have it, the issue on which that contest is being waged. Now, it's worth bearing in mind that to understand in more detail what's happening, we have to focus in on exactly what China is doing. I do think the Chinese policy in the South China Sea is, amongst other things, it's obviously intended to assert a series of claims to the nine-dash line and so on, but I think it's also intended quite specifically as a way to further the Chinese challenge to US primacy. And I think it works. I think the Chinese see the South China Sea as offering an opportunity to demonstrate its growing power, to demonstrate the relative decline of the US as a power. The United States is not in decline absolutely, but it's certainly in decline relatively to China. And to provide an opportunity for the Chinese to show that the United States can no longer exercise uncontested primacy and that it's going to have to start dealing with China as an equal. And it does that in a very simple way. In the end, ultimately, US power in Asia is based on its alliances and regional friendships with countries like Japan, Australia, the Philippines, and so on. And right at the heart of those relationships is the confidence those countries have that the United States will stand by them if they come under pressure, and in the present era, in particular, if they come under pressure from China. And it seems to me the South China Sea has offered China an opportunity, and I might also say confrontations in the East China Sea in relation to Japan, have offered China the opportunity to test America's willingness to stand up to China on behalf of its regional friends and allies, and for the United States to fail that test. So what the Chinese have expected and hoped has been that that as China put pressure over countries like the Philippines in the South China Sea or countries like Japan in the East China Sea, that the United States, that those countries would turn to the United States for support, as the Philippines did in the initial disputation over Scarborough back in 2012, and as it's doing again today, of course, and the United States would fail to provide its allies like Japan or the Philippines with sufficient support to stand up to China. The Chinese have been gambling that this is the way it would work, and so far that gamble has paid off. So far the United States has not been prepared to provide, the Philippines at least, there's an interesting question about Japan in relation to Senkaku, but not been able to provide the Philippines at least so far with sufficient support to make the Japanese, to make the Chinese back off. And the Chinese have hoped that that would undermine confidence in the United States' power, would increase respect for Chinese power, undermine US leadership, and bolster China's leadership. It's a pretty traditional, old-fashioned kind of mechanism in power politics. That's how power politics have been played for millennia, really. And the Scarborough Shoal, of course, has been a really critical point on that, and so has the island-building campaign that China's undertaken over the last couple of years. Now, the United States of course, has recognised this. I think we can say in general that the pivot is a clear attempt by the United States to push back against China's attempt to undermine US leadership. And more recently, I think the US, I think Washington made a decision early last year to regard the island building campaign in particular as a red line. That is, the United States has gone to a great deal of trouble to use the, you know, what Admiral Harris, speaking here in Canberra in April last year, described as the Great Wall of Sand, those reclaimed islands and the bases have been built on them, as a red line, as a point beyond which China must not go. And it's talked pretty tough about it. The problem is it hasn't done much. For example, it's talked a lot about freedom of navigation, but the freedom of navigation transits it's done, the US Navy has done, have failed to prevent the Chinese continuing to develop those islands. And there's a reason for that. The United States is deeply worried by what China's doing. It's also deeply worried about the idea of finding itself drawn into a conflict with China and is very reluctant to take military action which might result in a clash, which, of course, is just what the Chinese expected. So now, I would say over the last few months, 3 months in particular, the US has moved on to regarding China's response to the Hague Tribunal's award, the Hague Tribunal's decisions, as a next red line, as a test for China's respect for the international order in Asia and a test for China's respect for US leadership. And it's undertaken a very plain set of warnings to China on this. It's deployed not one but two aircraft carriers to the region, including having one carrier in the South China Sea continuously for a very significant period of time, the Stennis. It's reported, I think reliably, that President Obama personally and directly warned President Xi about the US response if China responded to the judgment by, for example, starting to build an island based on the Scarborough Shoals. Ashton Carter, the Defence Secretary, has made very plain statements. So the US has gone a long way towards making very plain warnings to the Chinese about the way they respond to the judgment. And in doing so, as one hopes, at least they hope, they've deterred the Chinese from doing anything too strong, perhaps even encouraged the Chinese to abide by the finding. But they've also, of course, to a certain extent, painted themselves into a corner. Because if China doesn't respond as the Chinese, as America has hoped, if the Chinese do undertake a significant counteraction, or even just don't abide by the findings, then the United States will have to face the question, well, we issued these warnings. What do we do if China doesn't pay attention to them? So that's where we are now. The big question is, what happens now? Everyone hopes, and most countries have said, that China will comply by the judgment. I think that is not very much that you can be pretty sure of in my line of work, but one thing I'm really sure of is that they won't comply by the judgment. One reason I think that, and again, I'm not by any means a lawyer myself, and so this is an amateur observation, and Lowell might have something much more sophisticated to say about this, but it seems to me the finding on the nine-dash line itself is something that the Chinese could, they would never have overtly walked away from it and just sort of said, oh, sorry, apologise, didn't mean to offend anybody, forget about the nine-dash line. They're never going to do that. But there's always been something a bit odd about the nine-dash line claim. The Chinese have never really articulated it themselves. And it seems to me that it would be possible if the Chinese wished to, that they could just sort of gently step back from the nine-dash line, just stop talking about it, and sort of over a period of years, the whole idea might just die away. And that would be a possible action for them without losing too much, you know, without humiliating themselves too much. So I don't think it's the tribunal's finding on the nine-dash line that really causes Beijing a problem. It's the finding on Subi and Mischief Reefs, which are two of the features on which China has built bases. Now, of course, the tribunal didn't have the right to decide whether those features belonged to China or to the Philippines or anybody else, but it did have the power to decide whether they could be owned by anyone. That is, whether they were low-tide elevations, which could not be subject to a sovereignty claim. They were essentially part of the seabed. And that's what they found on those two features. So two of the features on which China has spent hundreds of millions of dollars and has built big photogenic, we've all seen the pictures, bases, it doesn't own. Nobody owns it. Not that it doesn't own it in the Philippines. Nobody owns it. It can't be owned. It's part of the seabed. If it belongs to anybody, if anybody has authority over it, jurisdiction over it, it would fall, at least one of them at least, would fall within the Philippines EEZ. So if the Chinese were going to stay there, they'd have to go to the Philippines and say, please let us maintain a facility on seabed within your EEZ. They're not going to do that. Well, they have to dismantle the base and go home. That's not possible. So one of the things we need to bear in mind about the present situation is that the one thing we can be sure of is that China's not going to do what everyone says they have to do. And that's itself a pretty serious state of affairs. That's pretty significant. And so I think whatever else happens, we're not going to get a Chinese, even covert, gradual, gentle acquiescence, confirmation to the finding. But there are still two possibilities as to where it might go from here. The first is the Chinese might just ignore it quietly. Ignore it, keep doing what they're doing, but not do anything too high profile. So they continue to occupy the islands, they continue to assert their claims to them, they continue to develop them, but they don't do anything overt and very provocative over the next few weeks or months. Now that's not a great outcome. It's not a great outcome for the United States in particular, because the US does look weak. If, say, you know, every year that everyone who's involved in these issues meets in Singapore at the Shangri-La Dialogue, and it tends to be the high point of the year, a focus on these things. So if next year, by the time we get to the Shangri-La Dialogue, China hasn't done anything outrageous, but it just hasn't stepped back at all, and the United States has continued to talk up big about its determination to stop the Chinese doing this stuff, the United States is going to look very weak. In fact, the Chinese will have won. They'll have won their point. They'll have demonstrated that they can defy the United States and there's nothing the United States can do about it. And so that China could go quietly, just do nothing particularly provocative, but just stick to its claims, and it would, in doing that, succeed in slowly but surely strengthening its claim to contest US strategic leadership in Asia, and therefore undermine the whole basis of the rules-based order that we're used to. And alternatively, of course, the Chinese might escalate. Beijing might feel a bit more, bullish about this. And it has several options. It could declare an air defence identification zone. It could start to develop Scarborough Shoal as a base, which there's clearly been some evidence, some intelligence over the last few months that suggests that there are some preparations to do that. It could increase its force deployments on the islands it's already developed by deploying fighter jets there or something like that. It could do all of these things, or any number of these things. And it could do them tomorrow, 3 or 4 weeks from now. I'm not at all surprised they haven't done it immediately. That would be very provocative. But if they waited, say, a month or two and then announced that they were deploying fighter jets to the islands they've already developed, or declared an ADIS, or start to develop Scarborough Shoals, it would be extremely stark confrontation of the United States. But, well, it would leave the United States with a very big problem. What does it do? Well, I suspect, and I say that advisedly, I don't know this, but I suspect in Washington that what they're thinking is, if the Chinese do something provocative like this, and clearly Washington's very worried that they will, that the US could make an effective response to impose enough costs on China to make it back off from that without risking a military confrontation by undertaking trade and diplomatic sanctions. It could, for example, suspend the strategic and economic dialogue, the senior level dialogue that the Chinese and the United States have every year. It could suspend some discussions on some other things. It could suspend negotiations on a bilateral investment treaty, which has been a very big thing going on between Washington and Beijing these last couple of years. There's all sorts of stuff that goes on in the US-China relationship that the US could, subject to sanctions. And, of course, that would cost the United States something as well as China, because nothing the United States does with China, it's doing out of the goodness of its heart. But I think my feeling is that it's extremely unlikely that China would back off from an assertive set of postures in the South China Sea simply in the face of trade or diplomatic sanctions. I don't think anything that the United States could seriously contemplate would be big enough, would do China enough damage for it to back off for something which in the end matters so much to China. And that means the United States, if China does continue to be robust, has got to ask itself the question as to whether it's going to take military action. So say, for example, in the example which I guess is closest to home for the Philippines, the Chinese do, the Americans have obviously been concerned about, does start dredging sand, building an island and creating a base on Scarborough Shoals. Extremely provocative thing to do, probably the most provocative thing that the Chinese could do. So the question is, well, what actually can America do to stop them? Well, it could interdict Chinese maritime traffic around the Scarborough Shoals. They could say, you start sailing ships towards Scarborough Shoals, we will sink them. And the Americans can do that. I mean, it certainly has the capability to do that. But it would be a hell of a gamble. No doubt the Americans would do that, hoping that the Chinese, faced with that US resolve, would back off. And maybe they would. But this is where it gets very psychological and very strategic. Because maybe the Chinese would think to themselves, well, the Americans are hoping we'll back off. But if we push in, if we actually sail our ships up to Scarborough Shoals, will they actually sink them? Or will they chicken out? So it's a risk for a very significant game of chicken here. And neither side could start taking those steps without asking a very serious question about where this might lead. So here's where I'll finish. Imagine the scene in the Situation Room, you know, down there in the basement of the White House. You've seen it on television, seen it on the films. That's where decisions like this get made, usually at 3 o'clock in the morning. And so if the Chinese have started to develop Scarborough Shoals as a base, there's going to be a meeting in the Situation Room, and the Americans try applying trade and diplomatic sanctions, they make no difference. So there's going to be a meeting in the Situation Room in which the president is going to be asked to decide whether or not the United States should undertake a military interdiction. And on one side of the table, there will be people who will say to the president, US advisors, who will say, Mr. President, or if it's after November, January next year, it might be Mrs. President, Mr. or Mrs. President, the United States' strategic position in Asia, dating back to, 1853 and the black ships in Japan, will absolutely be undermined if the United States doesn't fulfil its obligations to the Philippines and fulfil its warnings to China and stand up to the Chinese. Our credibility will be finished, and their credibility will be significantly enhanced. For the United States not to go forward and fulfil the warnings we have already made, you have made personally to Xi Jinping, would be to abandon our place as a leading power in Asia. And American political leaders, going all the way back to Admiral Perry and President Grant and so on, would say, would have always sworn the United States would never do that. And it's true. That's absolutely true, what those guys have just said. But on the other side of the table, there are some people who say, perhaps in answer to the president's question, maybe the president asks them, well, what happens? I mean, do the Chinese back off? And the answer is, well, we don't know. Maybe they will, but we can't assume that. So the president says, well, what happens if they don't back off? Well, either we back off, in which case we look really weak, or we have to be prepared to start sinking ships. At which place the president said, oh, okay, well, that starts happening. Can you give me a estimate as to what our chances are of having a short, small, contained war that would produce a clear American victory within a couple of weeks? To which the admiral say, no, there's no chance of that. That's not the way the world is anymore. About 20 years ago, 25 years ago, I could promise you that. But that's not the way the world is today, partly because of the way China's developed its maritime capabilities. China's not nearly as strong as America is overall, but in the particular kind of conflict we'd be talking about, the Chinese got a lot of options. They can sink a lot of American ships. If we start sinking their ships, they'll start sinking ours, and they can. If we start shooting down their airplanes, they'll start shooting down ours, and they can. So they'd probably lose more than we would, but we'd still lose plenty. And, well, what is, you know, where does it go? Then said, well, if we really wanted to achieve a decisive outcome, we'd have to escalate. We'd have to escalate in intensity and in geographical spread. We'd have to take the war from outside the immediate area around the Scarborough Shoals and start destroying Chinese bases on the mainland from which their forces were operating. And we'd have to become more intense, bigger weapons and so on. And the president says, well, how do they respond to that? And they think, oh, well, they do the same. They'd attack our bases on Guam, maybe our bases in the Philippines, maybe our bases in Japan. The president said, oh, and do we win that? No. No, we just stabilise the conflict. It's just another stalemate at a high level of violence. And then if he's bright, he says, oh, no danger of this going nuclear, is there? Which the admiral says something like, well, that's such an interesting question. We don't really know. We don't quite know where the nuclear threshold is. So then he says, hang on, you think I might end up fighting a nuclear war with China over Scarborough Shoals? Which they say, well, it's not really about Scarborough Shoals, is it? It's about our whole leadership position in Asia, and so on. Well, it sounds extraordinary that this little issue, not a little issue to the Philippines, admittedly, but it's in a grand sweep of history, it's a little issue, could end up with questions of that magnitude. But that is precisely the situation we're in. That's why this is so important. That's why it's a little bit like 1914. One wants to be very careful about that analogy. But in the end, the First World War wasn't about Serbia and the poor old assassinated Archduke. Actually, the assassination of the Archduke was a pretty big deal if you were in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. He was the heir to the throne, after all. But what was at stake in 1914 was far bigger than that. And the problem for us, what makes the present situation so dangerous, is not only are there those very significant immediate issues that I talked about, but the whole bigger set of questions about leadership in Asia and the roles of the United States and China. I'm not for a moment sure there's going to be a war in East Asia starting in the South China Sea. But if there is, then we will look back and not say, we won't look back and say, whoa, where did that come from? We'll look back and say, oh, you can see how that started. This is how wars start. And that's one of the reasons why it's so important for us to manage this issue so carefully. Thank you.
I think people can hear me.
Recording.
For recording. I teach in first year law, so I'm used to having a big crowd and my voice could be heard. So it's always a pleasure to go to Canberra despite the 3-hour drive and your very cold, wintry, and especially NV Professor Hugh White, who I feel very humble to share the table because he just drives 5 minutes. He lives 5 minutes away from here, so. And before I begin my presentation, I would like to thank Imelda and Ali for inviting me. It's also a joy to see familiar faces in the crowd. Ambassador Minda Calagian Cruz, Consul General Nina Kainglet, the staff from the Philippine Consulate, and all you guys for coming over today to hear this presentation. So the topic of my presentation today is actually the South China Sea Arbitral Award. I decided to be quite modest with my title, so I've labeled it Preliminary Thoughts and Legal Implications, only because I don't want to disappoint you with very lofty and ambitious titles. So before I begin, please allow me to preface my presentation with a quote from Louis Henkin, which is widely considered one of the most influential contemporary scholars of international law, who said in 1979, that almost all nations observe almost all principles of international law and almost all of their obligations almost all of the time. So almost all nations observe almost all principles of international law, almost all of their obligations, almost all of the time. It's a very insightful statement which cuts through the very heart of the issue of compliance in international law. In other words, why do nations obey international law? In 1997, Professor Harold Koh, who was for a time dean of the Yale Law School and former legal advisor to the U.S. State Department, also said, like most laws, international rules are rarely enforced, but they usually obeyed. So there are a few occasions where they have to be enforced, but they're normally obeyed. So I believe this is the threshold question that has been highlighted in recent debates about the South China Sea. And today, as we re-examine the dispute, it's a good time to ask, what is the role and relevance of international law? Why do we need international law? Is international law the best, the most optimal solution to the South China Sea disputes? And in a nutshell, I believe, and speaking as a lawyer, we need international law when things go wrong, and other options, including the threat or use of force, is not lawful, not viable, or not practical. For instance, you probably wouldn't know or wouldn't care that there are laws that govern your relationship with your neighbor until the day you wake up and you find your neighbor building a structure on your fence, on your yard, or the day your neighbor takes the liberty to take some fruits from your tree in your backyard. So only then would you realize that you need international law. So with these points in mind, this is the same in international law. With these points in mind, in the next 20 minutes or so, I wish to address three following questions. Number one, how did we get here? So this is more for the layman in the crowd, and I apologize for those who are more specialists. I will just keep it brief just to give us an overview and to put us all on the same page. So how did we get here? The first part will cover an overview of the South China Sea disputes. It will look at some provisions of the laws of the Sea Convention. It will look at part 15, which sets out the dispute settlement mechanism. Number two, where are we now? So in the second part, I would look more closely at the arbitration filed by the Philippines against China. I would look at two things as well, the arbitration case, what reliefs did we ask for, what questions were put forth before the tribunal, and of course, the historic tribunal award on July 12, 2016. And finally, where are we going? Of course, this proceeds from the premise that we know where we want to go, and how do we get there? So in the last part, I will explore options for the Philippines, for China, some other claimant countries, and discuss possible scenarios how it will proceed. So before I became a full-time academic, I was actually a practicing lawyer, and one of the earliest memories of practicing law was clients coming to the office and asking us if they want to file a case against another person, a third party, what are the chances of this case succeeding? And this was also the same question asked before asked by the Philippine government when in 2012, I will look at this in a while, at the Haddad Scarborough incident, the Philippine president wanted so much, so badly to bring China to court. And the question was asked, what was the chances of this case succeeding? At that time, the Philippines was thought to be quite reckless, quite foolhardy. It was thought to be legally impossible to file this case, but look at where we are now. So in a nutshell, it's very clear that the case is actually a legal and moral victory, an overwhelming victory for the Philippines, and we would look at that today. So I would like to start with some bad news before I go with the good news. It's not as pessimistic as the scenario of war painted by Professor Yu, but slightly along those lines. So let me start with some bad news. The Philippine arbitration will not solve the dispute. So it's quite clear. It was not the question brought before the court. We were not asking the tribunal to rule who owns those islands, those features. The arbitration case will not resolve the dispute. If you look at the Law of the Sea Convention, there are no rules that are there that will resolve the disputes. Secondly, I flagged this, and I would expand this further on in succeeding slides. The Philippines has lost effective occupation of Scarborough Strait. So if you ask me, are we better off or worse off than we were in 1995, for instance, or 2012 or 2013, I can honestly say to you, sans the be without the Arbitral Tribunal Award, this is recorded on the intro. I think we're worse off. We're worse off because if you look at the things on the ground, we have lost effective occupation. There are seven reclamation activities there. I would not want to go further, only because it's on record. And if you look at the marine environment, we're even looking at a more bleak picture. So China's reclamation, as discussed by the tribunal in the award, has caused irreparable damage to the marine environment. So I would show you some pictures that were referred to by Professor Yu. and some of them you might have seen previously. Finally, this is the same conclusion by the first speaker. China has made it clear consistently, persistently, and quite dramatically, emphatically, that it will not honor the ruling. It did not want to participate in the proceedings. It thinks it's a farcical, null and void proceeding. And for that reason, how do we proceed? And if we look at international law, we don't have much hope either. There's no implementing mechanism. There's no global police force. Okay, so let's not lose hope. So I'm always very, very optimistic. But looking at the good news, so there's also some good news, of course. If you look at the award, I strongly believe, and most commentators would agree, it's an overwhelming legal and moral victory for the Philippines. This is not a small thing. The arbitral tribunal categorically, also emphatically, quite clearly and irrevocably said that China's 9-dash line finds no basis in international law. That's not a small thing. And it's incompatible with the law of the Sea Convention. So the court essentially says, you might have had historical rights, historic title over these expanses of water, but because you've signed into the convention, you've ratified it, it has entered into force, they're incompatible, they're deemed extinguished by the convention. And finally, despite China's protestations, the tribunal award is final, it's binding, there's no provision for appeal. It's enforceable and it carries very huge presidential weight, so it cannot be ignored. So just a brief overview, just as I said, to brief, put us all on the same page, not really to bore you. So if you look at South China Sea, why is it important? Professor, you already said it's not just for the resources, it's for geostrategic reasons. There are abundant resources there, hydrocarbon. It's subject to competing claims by 6 countries. I've included Taiwan for purposes of counting countries. So you have China, you have Taiwan, you have Vietnam, Malaysia, Brunei, Indonesia is counted as a 7th one because of incursions in the Tula Island. There are 4 archipelagos in that maritime region. All of the Cayman countries except for Brunei have garrisons in the area. It's complex because it involves international law, geopolitics, economics, international relations. And all of the claimant states, if you look at their claims, they're all based on international law, customary, conventional, the Law of the Sea Convention. There's been a steady alignment of claims along these lines over the years, especially in recent times. And even China is not an exception. And again, you see the bad news that UNCLOS has no provision for determining sovereignty over offshore features. So if you look at the convention, it's a very innovative convention. It's called the Constitution of the Oceans. It has a very comprehensive dispute settlement mechanism. So international law, normally, states cannot file a case against the other party without their consent. But with the Law of the Sea Convention, the compulsory dispute settlement mechanism makes it compulsory if you have a question of interpretation or application, another party could bring another party to court, subject to some exceptions, of course. So that's in Part 15, so, which means the convention includes consent. You no longer have to secure that. It's built in within the convention. This is only for the curious. So if you look at the convention, Article 279, there's the obligation to settle disputes peacefully. It cites the UN Charter. You can choose procedures of your choice. And of course, there are 298 exceptions, which China also signed in 2006. So just quickly, how did we get here? Many of you would have been aware, and Professor Yu has been mentioning the Scarborough Shoal. So at the height of the Scarborough Shoal incident, quote-unquote, there were Chinese vessels in Bajo de Masinloc, which is the term we call those features. There was a U.S. Negotiated mutual pullout, which didn't happen. The president felt that there was not much legal maneuver available for the country. And for that reason, we find ourselves with this case. So where are we now? We find ourselves with the Arbitral Tribunal Award. It was a very historic award. Much has been written about it already. But I want to flag, before I do that first point, I want to flag China's reclamation activities, because for me this is more, the South China Sea is very abstract, especially for people who have never been to the South China Sea, who are not from that area, who are not Filipinos. But if you look at these pictures, it will give you a clearer picture of what is happening on the ground. And of course, Professor Ward already alluded to this in the earlier presentation. So where are we now? We see this reclamation activity. So it will just be, I will just be flagging this picture. So these are some of the features occupied by China pre-reclamation and then post-reclamation. This is a picture of Fire Cross Reef in 2012. It's above water. It's about a meter above water at high tide. It's within the Philippine continental shelf. but outside the Philippine EEZ. And this is how it looked like in January 28, 2015. So you can see, even just to put some scale in the picture, you can see those huge ships dredging sand. Some of them are cargo supply vessels. A picture of Fire Cross Reef again. With these are public documents, by the way. This picture specifically, there's a proposal for a runway, which is 3,000 meters in length. Planned reclamation of in the scale of 200 hectares. This is Kagitingan Reef, again, Fire Cross Reef, an aerial view. Johnson South or Mabini Reef, PE reclamation. It's also a low tide elevation within the Philippine EEZ. And again, in May 2015, look at all those structures. Shigua Makenan Reef, PE reclamation. It's also an LTE within the Philippine EEZ. These are very huge structures, by the way. I mean, the next picture will give you how it looks like up close. Or maybe the next one. Gavin Reef. So they're multi-story, they're huge, it can accommodate the landing, the airships could accommodate big aircraft. It's Quarteron Reef. And Quarteron Reef in 2015. Subi Reef. And Subi Reef in 2015. Bishop Reef, the famous one, pre-reclamation, and of course in 2015 as well. Woody Island, you can see there's a very long runway that can handle China's aircraft, fighter aircrafts. Just a reminder that the convention mandates all states to protect and preserve the marine environment. And China's reclamation clearly destroyed irreparably the marine environment of the South China Sea. So if you look at the reefs there, it took millions of years for them to be formed. It will take a year or so just to destroy them. So forget about the hydrocarbon, forget about geostrategy. If you look at the South China Sea, it's really all about the fishes to the littoral states. They fish there. 10% of the world's catch come from the South China Sea. So if you destroy this reef, it will have very disastrous consequences for this fisher, for people who rely on them for the proteins as well as for their job. We look at the arbitration. So just a quick timeline. The case was filed in 2013. Of course, the Chinese made it clear from the very beginning, that it will not participate in the proceedings. It disputed the jurisdiction of the tribunal. It submitted the position paper in 2014. The tribunal requested additional information from the Philippines in December 2014. The Philippines made those submissions in March the next year. There was a hearing on jurisdiction and admissibility in 2015 of July. And the unanimous award on jurisdiction was handed in 2015 October. There were some hearings last year towards the end of the year on the merits. And finally, we have July 12, the final award on merits. So what did the Philippines ask the court to do? For those who are not aware, or just to give some clarity, the Philippines basically asked the court that the question whether the 9-9 is actually inconsistent with the law of the convention, whether it's valid, whether it's whether the convention should govern the rights of the parties in the South China Sea. Secondly, the court asked the Philippine government asked the court whether the features in the South China Sea are actually islands, low tide elevations, submerged banks, all these are terms of art in the law of the sea convention. So if you look at Article 121, you will know that islands are naturally formed land which are above water at high tide, which can sustain human habitation and have economic life of their own. The court in the decision discusses at length. So we have some criteria now to determine whether features are islands or rocks. Unfortunately, the court said they're all rocks. And I will discuss what that means in a while. And finally, whether the Philippines should be allowed to enjoy its rights and exercise them in the EEZ and continental shelf since they are established in the convention. So on all these three counts, the court actually took the Philippines' side. Finally, the Philippines is aware that it's not asking the court to rule on sovereignty. It's not asking the court to delimit any maritime boundaries. And it's very mindful of the 2006 declaration made by China. So it actually avoided that jurisdictional issue, so as to make it fall within the jurisdiction of the court. I won't really discuss this in much detail. There are 15 reliefs asked by the Philippines. again, overwhelmingly, the court decided in the country's favor. So if you ask me, what did they do on July 13, which is the day after the tribunal decision came out, I actually spent half a day reading through the 500-page arbitral award. It's a mammoth of a document, but for people like myself, it was actually a joy to read, and also because it was very heartwarming to see a lot of pronouncements in favor of the Philippines. So, but if you ask me what in my opinion would be the three most important, most salient pronouncements of the court, I would actually give you these three. The first one is that, and I cannot emphasize this enough, the China's non-dash-line claim find no basis in international law. So it's no longer valid. It's been refuted. We should not oblige China by allowing it to say that claim still holds water. Secondly, that the reclamation activities have interfered with the rights of the Philippines under UNCLOS. It has caused irreparable damage to the fragile marine environment. It violated the obligation of China under UNCLOS. And finally, none of the features in the disputed maritime area are islands, which means they cannot generate EEZ or continental shelf. They are merely rocks under Article 121.3, which means they can only generate territorial sea. So what is the court doing here? The court is actually saying that they were trying to avoid a situation where you would have pockets or enclaves or overlapping maritime areas. So it's a very simplistic but very wise solution. So the court was saying, even though there are features, Scarborough Shoal is one of them, which are actually rocks, which means they can be appropriated by a state, they cannot generate more extensive zones than just than territorial sea, which means even if China, for the sake of argument, would have ownership, sovereignty over those features, it would not be to an extent as to overlap with the EEZ of the Philippines. And for that reason, I think it's really a major victory, because the other things that also Professor Yu mentioned was that Mr. Freef, Reed Bank, Second Thomas Show, the tribunal said that they were actually not rocks or islands, they are low tide elevations, which means there's some birch features, they're part of the continental shelf. They cannot be appropriated, which means they belong actually to the Philippines. They can, even though some of them might have been used by China for reclamation activities, that is no consequence. They have to abide by the tribunal's ruling that they cannot be subject to appropriation. So what are the options for the claimant countries? I'm almost done with my presentation. So for the Philippines, it can still continue with other non-compulsory procedures. So if you look at the convention, it allows for mediation, conciliation, it allows for bilateral negotiations. The Philippines can still do that. The question of sovereignty is still unresolved, so the Philippines can still adjudicate on that issue. They can file a case, of course, with the consent of China, if you can secure that. You can also still proceed with bilateral negotiations based on the tribunal award. I want to emphasize that. It can also enforce the tribunal award. So other than the scenarios painted by Professor Yu, you can also enforce the tribunal award more tangentially. For instance, a more practical example would be if there would be an oil concession in Reed Bank, which China would not honor, or they would harass, for instance, you can file a trade dispute with ICSID, for instance, to have that enforced. If there are activities done by China on our EEZ or continental shelf, you can file a case with the seabed authority. So it's not really a Pyrrhic victory. It's not an empty victory. There are things which could be done legally, and of course, people from the Philippines are aware of this. China, of course, I put there more wishful statement. It can honor or comply with the award. I also seriously doubt that. It can align, it can take this opportunity to align its territorial and maritime claims with international law and UNCLOS. It could also choose to go within the system, so it can contest the interpretation or application of the award. It can also resort to other non-compulsory procedures. It can still continue with negotiation. For the other claimant states, it's easy to paint a scenario that they can even piggyback or right on the waves of this award, filing their own cases. They can initiate their own compulsory processes as provided for by the convention. They can also continue with their negotiation. And of course, they can still align their claims with international law and UNCLOS. So just some final words. I see this award as carrying really heavy presidential weight. So China has done has really gone out of its way to disparage the tribunal, to disparage the proceedings, to disparage the award. But I think it does carry heavy presidential weight, and it should be the starting point of any bilateral negotiation. It's something that cannot be ignored. It has to be acknowledged. I flagged this quite seriously, that there are disconcerting allegations made publicly by Chinese diplomats. Actually, I was in Canberra just a week ago, and there was a... I'm afraid now because it's unrecorded. Before I sat down, I went to a... Anyway, I would not name the person. I went to a closed-door round table, and before I sat down, there was a Chinese professor who actually said to me very threateningly, "You are the most hated person in the room." And he really said it in a very threatening manner. And I think this really encapsulates the attitude of the Chinese at the moment. They feel betrayed. They feel anger. They feel quite rightfully so. You cannot blame them. And on the part of Manila, you can see there's muted jubilation. There's feeling, but there's no triumphalism. And if you look at our new Philippine president, you can see he's more amicable to China, which is very well received by China as well. So there should be continued diplomatic and peaceful means to solve the disputes. These are more motherhood than anything, but they're quite meaningful statements, I believe. They should also exercise self-restraint, non-use of force. There has to be a rules-based approach to this, resolving the disputes based on UNCLOS and other rules of international law. So if you ask me what are my predictions, I think in the post-arbitration scenario, that period will be likely defined by a very belligerent, very defiant China. And as I said, that's very understandable. But there should be some expected risk of miscalculation. There could be heightened possibility of armed conflict, but not war, as other commentators would like to paint. But in the long term, and I believe this is shared by many scholars as well, it should be expected that bilateral relations between the Philippines and China will be mended, it will be restored. I believe it's more robust, more resilient, more comprehensive than just our claims in the South China Sea. I refuse to acknowledge the David and Goliath analogy, but I think at the end of the day, it really, and as a lawyer, I think international law should be regarded as the real victor in this award. It is the great equalizer. It just shows you that might is not right, that you can still rely on international law to enforce your rights. And for me, that's the true essence of the victory in this case. Thank you.
Thank you for two very fascinating and thought-provoking presentations from our two presenters. So. Thank you for the very thought-provoking and very fascinating presentation from our two presenters. And reflecting on this, I was actually tempted to have a very sad sort of gloomy sort of reflection on this. But and I think this is more of a question as the moderator. Maybe I can pose the first question. Whether actually there exists...